Welcome, everyone. This is Mia Ferraletto, publisher of New Observations magazine. Welcome to the New Observations podcast. Today, I am delighted to welcome to the show Rachel Portese, who is an extremely talented photographer. I'm not sure where Rachel is from originally, but we are fellow Vermonters at this moment in time. Rachel, welcome to the show.
Hi, Mia. Thank you. I'm so happy to be here.
Oh, it's wonderful to have you here. And I want to say a couple of things first. At the moment, Rachel has a stunning exhibition at the Brattleboro Art Museum in Brattleboro, Vermont. It's just a knockout show of her photographs of women that are breathtakingly beautiful and inspiring in terms of the divine feminine in its purest essence of beauty and creativity. So thank you so much for sharing your work with the public in that way. And
well, thank you for your compliments on my work.
Oh, it's just stunning. And particularly meaningful in the time of the COVID virus right now, when we need to be inspired as much as possible on every level, and to see, for me and for many others, beauty is one of the doorways to higher realms of thought, and your work just evokes such a sense of the divine feminine, but also bringing the natural world into it with the way that you use plants and flowers, and it's just remarkable work and so timely as women are currently striving and succeeding, slowly but succeeding, in reclaiming our space in the world. It's just such important work at this moment in time. And to do it with beauty in the way that you do, instead of a sense of strident demanding, because, you know, the beauty and the elegance and the primal force surrounding that intelligence is really what women are all about. You know, we don't have to be about hammering people over the heads to claim who we are. You know, this is the natural force that we've been given. So, you know, I can't say enough about your work. It inspires me every time I look at it.
Oh, Mia, thank you so much. And it's nice to hear your thoughts about these women, the power of the women in these images. I was really taking a look at my own life and of my young models' lives and thinking about my parents and wanting to make images that honored, you know, female identity, but on a woman's terms, I think, like sexuality that was for their own pleasure. Or, you know, and the, you know, the flowers representing the natural female, the nature of women in general. I tried to make them very powerful, but for themselves, and celebrate their beauty, and trying to think of it as women claiming it for themselves rather than for the pleasure of men or how society feels they should view women. So it's nice to hear you say.
Well, you succeeded beautifully, and also the way you're placing, you know, the plants and integrating them with the women, you're communicating in a subtle and powerful way that women are in fact not just immersed in nature, but one with nature. We are part of that cycle and that life force, and it just comes through so poetically, but also in such a strong way. I think your I think you're opening a new chapter, actually, in terms of how women need to perceive themselves. And that's another reason why I admire your work so much. So thank you for
that. Thank you. I think there's something to that, you know, in politics, in the workforce, women, I think, had to almost emulate men for a while, be one of the guys to be taken seriously. And I think, you know, we're ready to move beyond that. I mean, certainly women can be, have classic kind of male, ways that they present themselves. But I think that, they've had to, in some ways, hide their part of their femininity or use it in this kind of a sexual way in the past to move forward. I think there's a way of embracing the whole woman in all of her ways, her masculine and feminine side together. I think there's a lot of strength in that.
Absolutely. I think that's a wonderful observation. So tell us how you got involved in photography in the first place.
Well, you know, I was always interested in art as a child. I loved, at one point in elementary school, this woman would come in and talk about paintings with us, and I was always right up front, like so excited. My parents took me to museums, and I loved it. I was so engaged, and at one point even we visited artist studios. I was always in the art room during free periods at school, drawing, painting, making anything. I was just hungry for it. And in high school, I had this horrible art teacher. It sounds like it's something from a John Hughes film or something that couldn't even be written. But this guy, it was nice to me, but he would literally rip student work up and harass them in class. It made for a volatile environment. And so just over on the other side of this large art room was the photography class, and I just switched. So I started taking photography, and my father had taken photographs before, so he handed over his Pentax K1000, and I never looked back. I loved making images. So at age, I don't even know, 15, 16, so I'm at 36-plus years of taking photographs.
Wow. And are you using an older camera now? How do you make your images? Because they have a very beautiful vintage quality to them. How are they processed?
So what I'm making now, they're called wet plate collodion tintypes. And technically what they are, they're direct positives made in the camera. If you think of it like a really old-fashioned Polaroid, it's the best way to imagine it. My camera's huge because these plates are up to 14 by 14 inches because they're direct positive. The back of the camera has got to be that size, be able to hold a plate that size in a plate holder. And the lens has to be big enough and the camera big enough to let enough light to expose a plate that size as well. And so it's a process that was popular. It's one of the earliest photographic processes. So if you see Civil War photographs, those are wet plate collodion tintype. So I'm using this really archaic form of image making. Yes.
It's perfect. It's perfect for your subject matter.
I think so. There's something about the struggle with having this kind of romantic look that I like and trying to make something new of an old process. Like you see images and you expect a certain thing. There are a lot of portraits of people made this way and a lot of older photographs. But I was trying to, make something new from this old. And sometimes when I look at these images, I feel like there's kind of this uncovered matriarchal tribe of really strong women, like left untarnished by by men or the patriarchy or other other elements that have kept us down throughout the years when I look at them. So
I think it comes through loud and clear, honestly. And, I'd be curious to hear what your male audience has to say, but you have captured, you know, the archetypal women image of women, of natural women. That's something else that I find so powerful every time I look at your work.
Thank you.
You've connected to the goddess energetically.
Yes, and I'm making images directly, you know, that try to that look like goddesses. I feel like these photographs really, women have responded to them primarily. I feel like I'm making photographs of women for, I feel like they're for women, and that's who mostly responds to them. I had a male artist visit my studio at one point who I admire, and I was showing him my work, and he at one point said something like, that I hadn't quite, I don't know, something to the effect like I hadn't quite captured the oozing sexuality from these young women, and I thought, oh my God, for a moment I thought, oh my God, no one's going to want this or be interested in this. And then I thought, wait a minute, that's kind of exactly what I've been trying to show, that there is another kind of sexuality. And then I thought, I've kind of captured that. And maybe it's fine if men don't respond to them. And since then, I thought of them as being for women. I'm not sure.
It's fine if men don't respond to them because, you know, they really are empowering for women. That's, you know, that's, we've been given this mirror ourselves. And it's a reflection of how men see us. As in my opinion, you've found, you know, this interior self that we all possess as women, and you've brought it out, and your photos are essentially saying to women, oh, this is who you are at the core. This is your essence. This is you.
Yes.
And that's such a gift.
It really helps that the women I worked with photographing were so, it was interesting for me how strong they are at their young age, their early 20s, and I was thinking back to myself at age 20 and then my mom at age 20 and thinking how we have really changed and grown, you know, in these three generations of women to be, they're so much more self-assured, self-confident, and they own themselves. It was a pleasure and a celebration to see. I felt in some ways I was celebrating that and kind of reparenting myself in some way and, you know, forgiving my young parents for being different. I don't know. It all was wound into one piece in that regard.
It's a process. As a mother and a wife and an artist, I'm curious to know how the COVID virus and the quarantine have influenced your art-making process, your creative process, and also if you've noticed any tweaks or changes in consciousness throughout 2020 as we've progressed through this phase of the virus.
Yeah, I think, you know, probably my experience is much like other people. It's been a wild roller coaster ride, you know, from the beginning where, you know, suddenly what was really important came so clear. And honestly, my work wasn't even anywhere on that list. It was my husband, my kids, my parents, and just a few friends who I really love. Like somehow the circle of important people in my life became really clear, and it became the only thing that seemed to matter. You know, I thought of like, I thought we were diving into a rapid great recession and so depression, I mean. And I thought, like, okay, what are the important things? Like, we have a roof over our heads. We need food. We need to support each other. That's very much how I was feeling at the beginning of the onset of this COVID virus in the spring. And then, of course, came the phase where my kids were doing online learning for the whole second half of last year. It's been interesting where my priorities are. And at the time when the virus hit, I had been making these images of roadkill, that I have in my freezer. I was thinking a lot about death and trying to come to terms and process, like, and find a way to be comfortable with the idea of dying. But the minute COVID happened, I couldn't touch that. It felt really raw and frightening.
How interesting.
Yeah.
Do you feel that was like some precognitive impulse pre-virus? That it's such a departure from the current work on view.
Yeah, it's something that death has always been some kind of part of my work, and even some of the hair portraits that are on view at the museum are about death. For me, and this was just another level of physically handling death, which I thought I had some idea leading up to making those that, like, I've come to terms with death, like, I'm comfortable with this, but then actually handling a dead thing, even an animal, it was so incredibly hard to do. It hurt. It ached. Like, death is unpleasant and disturbing, really. And I forced myself to make some of these images. And it was like taking a bitter pill or something. Anyway, I don't know.
I can imagine.
Yeah. It's not the reaction I expected to have. I was like, all right,
uh-huh.
I got this. But then you have like a dead raccoon dripping blood on your studio floor.
Wow.
I've always been interested in thinking about these animals that are along the roadside that are dead, and they hurt my heart, you know, especially birds of prey. And my friend hit a raccoon, and she was distraught, and I'm like, let's go get the raccoon. And like, that's how it started. We went and picked up the raccoon. And I'm like, I'm just going to make a photograph. I'm going to honor this raccoon and then bury it, you know. And it was kind of like part of a healing thing. And then people started bringing me all kinds of roadkill.
Oh, wow. I want to come back to this, but we're going to take our first commercial break. So we'll be.
How curious are you? How much do you really want to know about the world you live in? There are, for example, very real conspiracies. We've been talking about one of them today. And this is a place where if it's real, we're going to talk about it, but not if it's not real. So there's no confusion here. If we're talking conspiracy on Dreamland and on unknowncountry.com, it's because we can prove it, just like we can prove that the Roswell incident has been covered up. We can prove these things. We can prove that the abduction phenomena is in some way very real. We can prove that there are unusual materials in this world because some of them are right here in my possession. So, this is an unusual place. It's a unique place. And above all, it is a great place to explore. Exploring the unknowncountry.com archive is a really extraordinary experience. It's a place where you can regain what we are losing, which is a lost sense of wonder and a willingness to explore the unknown. We live in a terribly difficult world right now. This place is an oasis of wonder. Join unknowncountry.com today.
Whitley's new book, A New World, is getting great reviews. American cosmic author Diana Walsh Pasulka says, enter this risky new world and leave empowered. New York Times reporter Leslie Keene says, riveting, I couldn't put it down. Amazon reviewers are calling it life-changing, mind-opening, the first real description of what contact is like and will be like. Don't miss A New World. As Professor Jeffrey Kripal says in his preface, this book is contact. Get A New World today. Available as a paperback, a hardcover, and an ebook wherever books are sold, and as an audiobook read by Whitley on audible.com.
Welcome back to the show. It's so interesting that you should have this connection to the animals by the side of the road, because I do too, and it disturbs me tremendously. And every time I pass a dead animal on the road, I always say a prayer for it, because I truly believe that animals are on their own spiritual path. And there's a profound sadness for me when I know that they've been hit by a car, you know, simply trying to live their life.
Yes.
As they're, you know, as they're meant to. There's a tragic element to, you know, our civilization encroaching on the, on their world.
Without a doubt, it breaks my heart, the effect of our existence on the animals. It really does. I was on a whale watch once with my son's school, and this whale came right up to the boat, like really close. Maybe they tell this to everyone who goes on a whale watch, you had the best experience ever. But this whale was in its eye. I just looked at it, and I just burst into tears. I felt some connection. I don't know about, maybe not a connection to the whale, but I just felt like I am so sorry for what you've done to this planet and to you. Yes.
Did you happen to notice I had this experience, but I'm curious if you did, because you're in Vermont also. It seemed to me, once we went into quarantine for about a month or so, that everything here became more vibrant. Trees, you know, were happier. There were so many more birds out over here in the Chester area. And I know, for instance, that the dolphins returned to the canals in Venice. It just seemed that everything was in a more vibrant, peaceful state. And that could be projection on my part, but I definitely sensed that there was a difference.
I felt the same, and I think a lot of it had to do with, I didn't know if all these animals were out celebrating, or if also, like, there weren't cars on the road or as many planes. It was really a different sort of quiet. And I couldn't tell if the animals were out, like, hurrah, people have slowed down, or if maybe the world slowed down enough for us to just feel their presence a little bit more and see them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm not sure. But I do want to mention that the canal in Venice thing is not real. I thought it was.
But isn't it?
I put it on Facebook myself. No, it was some kind of internet joke something. It's my understanding.
Oh, really?
I looked it up. Yeah, it was debunked by Snopes or something. But I was telling everyone about it, celebrating the dolphins. I did the same thing that you said, yes.
So you have to be careful with Snopes as well, because they don't always tell the truth. But,
oh, really? I use that to do dolphins all the time, and shoot.
Yeah, no, they're not the most reliable source. Look at the mainstream media.
I know.
You know,
is there anything reliable? That's what I want to know. I mean, I trust NPR and some journals to a large extent, but
I think we've really reached the point where we have to do all of our own research from multiple sources and then use our own intuitive skills and processing skills to determine what's accurate and what's not, because we're fed so much disinformation on every level.
And doing that is so counter to how we've evolved to live right now, which is in tiny snippets and memes and little bits. I feel like people don't have the patience or won't take the time to do research like that. It's actually hard to do. It's an interesting, we're going in opposite directions that we need to all at the same time.
Well, plus Google is editing what's available online every day. I've found obscure articles on various subjects, and then I've gone back to find them again, and they're gone.
Interesting.
It's, and I'm a bit of an activist, and more than a year ago, I was censored from YouTube completely, and I don't even post videos, but my comments really about people, you know, getting involved in their communities, making a stand, and I got, without a warning, I was banned from YouTube, and every single comment I posted was taken down.
Oh my goodness.
I'm at the forefront of research that's going on right now.
It's interesting, censorship. You know, we don't want to spread misinformation, and at the same time, we have freedom of speech. It's an interesting question. And I had my entire Instagram account deleted because I just found something had boobs on it. I didn't even think of it because, you know, they're in my artwork, and my whole account and all my followers gone in an instant without warning.
See, there you go.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
Amazing. And yet your work is so positive.
Yeah, I guess boobs, someone saw them and didn't think it was okay.
Oh, well. Yeah. Crazy time we're living in. I, you know, there's a sense of reordering that things are, you know, the deck is being shuffled and things are being ordered in a new way.
I look forward to seeing how it plays out, especially since we're so global now, you know, and all these people with different views and different, you know, different ways of living. It'll be interesting to see how the deck does shuffle.
Absolutely. So now that the exhibit is up in Brattleboro, where do you see this work headed? Have you explored, or is the museum exploring traveling this exhibition in any way?
I'm currently in some conversations, and I'm definitely looking for it to move to another location, very much so. I'm not sure exactly what form that'll be, but I'm feeling more and more confident that it'll have a home elsewhere after, you know, at some point in the near future from the time the show closes.
That's great. And have you considered the possibility of taking portraits of women from different cultures or age groups, or, you know, expanding the variation in any kind of way?
I really have been on the lookout. I found one female to model for me years ago who had long gray hair, like white gray, and I photographed her against a black background. And that, for me, was incredibly inspiring. And I have yet to find someone else. I mean, I do live in a little bubble, in fact, in a small town in Vermont. It's not like I meet a lot of people or anything, but I put the word out looking for someone with long gray hair. I found one amazing woman who didn't want a model, and I think now I've found another. So far, my models have just come to me organically. They've both been young women who were interested in learning about photography, and they happened to have long hair similar to mine, and it folded in that way. But I'm on the lookout for really white gray hair that's long. So if anyone out there has that, it might be time. You know, I suppose COVID's not the time to put an advertisement out on Craigslist or something, but I hope to find someone that I connect with to work with.
Well, I have two suggestions. One is Dominique Browning, the former editor of House and Garden magazine. She has, or had, I don't know what her current hairstyle is, but for the past couple decades, she's had gorgeous long gray hair. And there's that model from J. Crew who started the cosmetics company Boom.
She's someone I found totally inspiring, actually.
Inspiring. She has an entire community of gray-haired women.
Well, maybe I need to get in touch with her. It never occurred to me to reach outside, like, word-of-mouth people I know exactly, or think about, you know, some. But those are great leads. And you're right. She probably does know a lot of gray-haired ladies.
Yeah,
I
bring her up.
Those women personally. Do you?
No, I don't. But I'm a master at writing to total strangers. That's what I do best.
I
9 times out of 10, you get a yes. In terms of reaching out, people are way more receptive than one would think. So I really encourage you, you know, to do that, because I think that there's a whole series of possibilities with what you're doing.
Without a doubt. And you know, in the past and during the making of a lot of this work, you know, I'm a busy mom also running my own business, helping run my husband's business. It was hard to find time to search for models, but I definitely have that time now. So I will reach out. I might read my email first. If I'm asking the right way. I'm not great at reaching out like you are. But I think those are great leads.
Well, I'm happy to help. And we're about to take our second and final commercial break, so we'll be right back.
Did you know that practically all of my books in print are now available directly on the new UnknownCountry.com store? Go to UnknownCountry.com, click on the store tab on the masthead, and explore. You can find everything there from A New World all the way down to some older titles like Black Magic, which is actually about remote viewing, but it's not about the public remote viewing program. It's about something else rendered into fiction. All kinds of interesting stuff in this store. A whole lifetime of my discoveries and explorations in fiction and nonfiction. Make use of the UnknownCountry.com store. It's a lot of fun.
When Plato's ancestor Solon received the story of Atlantis from this Egyptian priest, the Egyptian priest said to him, "Many and manifold are the destructions of mankind. You have know of but one, but you Greeks are like children. There are many, many destructions of mankind by all various types of means."
That's an excerpt from a show with Rand Flemath, who wrote the original book about crustal shift that is based on the theories of Charles Hapgood. There are three Dreamlands with Rand over the years. That one's from 2015. He goes all the way back to 2004. And they are totally relevant and totally fascinating right now. All you have to do to locate those shows is go to our search engine on unknowncountry.com and input the words Flemath, FLEM-ATH, his last name, and all of the shows will pop up. And then, if you want to listen to these incredible programs, literally available nowhere else on earth, as far as I know, you can subscribe to unknowncountry.com for $4.95 a month, or $39.50 a year. And when you do, you get a literal wealth of enjoyment from this website, including the full-length Dreamland every week, every new Dreamland that comes up. So subscribe to unknowncountry.com. Go to the site and click on the subscribe tab. Get started. Now subscribers can also listen through any app that accepts subscription-based podcasts. One that we use is the Castro app, and it works great. You can have Dreamland pushed to your app every week. Subscriber now, just as you can, as a free Dreamlander.
Welcome back to the show. So, Rachel, with all that you have going on in your hectic life, I'm curious to know if there have been any, like, subtle differences during the time of the virus. Have you noticed, for instance, as one example, an increase in your intuition, or have your dreams been more complicated and revealing in any way? Do you feel that you've gotten closer to the interior Rachel through this quieter time?
You know, after I reached the phase of being sort of terrified by the virus, I think again, really so much of it has to do with appreciating the people and environment around me on a different level. And it's interesting you should bring up dreams because I have the most rich dream life. But I think it kind of, now that you say that, I thought I really have not been having so many dreams since COVID, which is surprising to me because I'm normally sorting out a lot of what's inside me through my dreams. So I don't know, maybe it's put my dreams on hold.
or actually you may be sorting in your wake time as opposed to in your dream time.
Yeah, I suppose with less interruptions from the outside world, that's entirely possible that my mind has more time to sort it out while I'm awake. I like that theory better.
Well, Vermont has, you know, Vermont has dealt quite well, I think, with the virus.
Yes.
We're lucky to have a small population here. And people, you know, Vermonters are pretty stoic dealing with the weather and the challenges that come from living in an environment like Vermont. You know, you have to be committed, I think, to being here, certainly historically, and, you know, job opportunities and so forth are, you know, limited here. The beauty is incredible, but there are other challenges that Vermonters face on a regular basis. So I think psychologically we're more apt to go along in hard times to cooperate. And I mean, Vermonters have an incredibly rich history of helping each other and working together in times of disaster or hardship.
Without a doubt, there's something comforting about being surrounded by farms where there's food and produce and people with the skills to can, et cetera. But like when you get down to it, I think that feels really good. And also, as Vermonters and the pandemic go, I heard this hilarious joke, maybe you've heard it as well, where someone said, you know, they told Vermonters they needed to stay 6 feet away from each other, and the old Vermonter said, well, that sounds awfully close. I'm thankful that we have a lot of space between us.
That's really true. and psychologically true, too, because, you know, Vermonters are very skeptical of outsiders as well.
Yeah.
I mean, I was born here, so I am not a Flatlander, but...
You're a real Vermonter, then.
I am.
But were your parents born here?
No, they weren't. They weren't. My father went to medical school here, and I was born his first year, so that's why I'm the only one out of five children born in Vermont.
Love it.
But nevertheless...
It's a badge of honor.
It didn't help when I moved here. I mean, I still had to go through the process of being examined and semi-accepted.
Yeah, right? I love that about Vermont in some way. New Englanders, you've got to earn it.
You've got to earn it, exactly. Talk about, you know, the change in terms of your creative cycle when your kids had to stay home from school and how that did that interrupt your flow in any way?
Oh, 100%. It 100% interrupted my flow. I did not have time to work or produce with that during that time at all. Yeah, I just stopped working. And it really, at the time, I wasn't even lamenting the loss of that. I was just thankful to feel safe. And I knew, I didn't worry that it wouldn't, you know, that it would never come back or anything. I felt thankful for the time for us all to be together and for me to be there for them, to feed them, bring snacks, be supportive during a time when they suddenly can't see their friends anymore and trying to learn on Zoom. My practice completely halted at that point.
That must have been really difficult for them.
Yeah, I think, you know, especially as, you know, my stepdaughter is well into her teenage years and my son's just entering his, you know, they're supposed to be breaking free from the house and, you know, trying things on their own. And I think to be stuck at home with us, I think it is really hard on them, for sure. So.
Well, your husband is also an artist. Eric Aho is a wonderful painter, and you were both preparing for exhibitions at the same time through this COVID virus.
Yes.
How did that work for you?
Mine was originally scheduled in June, and then it was postponed. I didn't even know if it would be rescheduled at all. I was thrilled to have it rescheduled, but it landed right when my husband also had an opening. And I photograph all of his paintings. I do a lot of the behind the scenes work and keeping his business up and running. So I first had to put his stuff before my own to get his work to the gallery in New York. You know, our ability to pay our bills totally depends on that. So there were a few moments for the first time where we're both being artists at the same time where it was a little intense. And it was a little bit in conflict with what I really needed to be focusing on my show, and I was focusing on his. And in the, 13 years that we've been living together in this house working, it was thankfully the first time that I felt really pulled by my wants and desires and what I needed to do for him. So, and we made it through the fight, but there were a few toughy moments for me personally.
Well, these are extraordinary times. This is not the norm in any way, although I do feel that it's opening a whole new thing for all of this, but we're not quite there yet. I'm quite left behind the old paradigm just yet, but we're on our way. Can you share with us some of your ideas about trends that you see happening for women artists right now, as we move forward, post COVID virus, but also post, patriarchy, post, Donald Trump, not to get into the politics of it all, but, from a gender, perspective, he sort of represents, you know, the old misogynist way of viewing women as objects. Where do you see us headed as a woman artist and the contemporary world post a Trump presidency, post patriarchy?
Yeah, you know, I feel like his existence and influence really caused women to maybe like find a voice and shout it out a lot more loudly than before. I think it inspired people like a sort of creative call to arms. I mean, so much artwork became directly related to things he was saying and doing, and women were protesting through their art. And I feel like in general, it's really nice to see that women are being taken way more seriously in the art world, that it's now a requirement. I think museums are rethinking their museum collections and galleries who they represent, not only for women, but, non-binary people, you know, all sorts of people, just to be more inclusive. And I think that's an exciting moment. And I think it speaks to what's to come. I think that we're in some sort of, a kind of different renaissance or revolution of art right now. It'll be interesting to see how it all settles out. But
I think that's really true.
About things. you know, the art world maybe thinks about things before the rest of the world can. So I think if we're looking at what's happening in art, we're looking at a promise of what's to come.
And do you see that, you know, spreading into indigenous communities? And, you know, many of your models have kind of an indigenous feel to them, whether they, you know, whether or not they are, in fact, hereditarily people. But there's, you know, that kind of native quality in some ways to some of your models. Do you feel that, because, you know, that's an additional whammy, so to speak, of, not only being, female, but being indigenous too. Do you feel that that will help, or this change is going to help specifically indigenous people get ahead that much quicker at this moment?
I do. I think that in film and art, people are suddenly maybe stopping to ask why other people are the, you know, white people are the ones making work about indigenous people, and questioning. I think people are trying to step back and let some of these other voices, some other people speak for themselves. I think there's a lot of value in that. I'm curious and interested to see what happens on that level as well. There's a lot of interesting discussion to be had around that. Like, are we allowed to look at the other and take it in and think about it? And I think that we are. But at what point does that become oppressive to other people? Because they also need to speak for themselves. So, it's an interesting and endless, conversation to be had around that, I think.
I've been fascinated with the indigenous grandmothers who are traveling around the planet, you know, holding ceremonies and speaking to other people about their wisdom and what's going on with the planet, with Mother Earth, how we can come together to save the planet, literally, as we deal with all these environmental issues, which are life-threatening and capable of destroying us in a very short period of time. And I do feel that your work, again, kind of personifies that energy that they, even though they're elders, are you know, sharing and emitting to the rest of us. It's just an interesting progression that I see happening, and again, not in a militant way, but in a very strong, powerful way.
Yep. Wow, so much just ran through my mind as you were speaking about that, thinking about our planet and what's happening to it. I have a lot of, anger and frustration at large corporations polluting our planet and then not paying for it and not fixing it, and that we have to squabble amongst ourselves for how to take care of this if it really is a problem. It's interesting. And meanwhile, you know, I'm thinking about how these elders are coming around, like you just mentioned, and I think there's been a real draw to making things from handmade goods, this kind of passing along of past traditions seems to be, I just want to say, kind of in style right now for those that can afford it. So I kind of feel like all the people, you know, who've benefited from the damage to the planet can afford to buy things handmade and preciously made in this old way, while a lot of other people feel like they have to shop at Walmart. Those are some quick thoughts that passed through my mind with what you were saying.
It's a real movie, in a way, what we're going through right now. And it's very much, in one sense, like there's so much that we're seeing in films in advance that, in fact, is becoming reality, our reality, as we look around us. And I know in my own life, I have clothes and material goods, really, I think, to last for the rest of my life if I use them wisely. I mean, in any way, grocery store, I need never shop again. So it puts, you know, our material needs in question. Having lived in Manhattan for 18 years, you know, I mean, I was a loyal Bergdorf Goodman shopper for all of those years, basically. Mm-hmm. And, you know, those days are long gone. So we're putting our actual needs in perspective, post-virus, I think. And
yeah,
also understanding, you know, understanding billions live without these things, things that we take for granted.
Yes, yep. And I think there's a huge, like, socio-economical and cultural, if you will, divide in that. I mean, in the accessibility of well-made things, in the accessibility to culture, museums, art. I've thought a lot about that. I think that, you know, we're lucky, we're privileged to be able to think like that and to think about what type of produce we're buying and make those decisions. And yes, we all do have enough in our closets, I'm sure, to last a lifetime. And it, you know, we're such a consumer-based society. It's such a strong impulse that I share, you know.
Yeah, I think anybody reading magazines is heavily influenced in the shopping department. It just, you know, keeps the branding and the desire for more going. But
yeah,
it's gotten so out of control.
At the same time, it's like what's holding our economy up. Sorry, what were you going to say?
Well, our economy, such as it is at this moment in time, and actually, that's an interesting point that you're raising in terms of the economy, because you know the art world has been so out of whack for a long time now with these obscene prices for individual works of art, you know, in the multi-million dollar range. The auctions are unbelievably skewed. And the idea that, you know, these works of art are being sold at auction from one private collection out of view of the public and then go back into another private collection, never to be seen again until, you know, someone's family decides to sell it. You know, to all of us, and historically in many cultures, that art in life has become such a field for the elite. It's a very strange dynamic. I'm curious to hear your thoughts about that, and if the virus has influenced that with so many people now sharing their art online with accessibility for everyone.
Yeah, I mean, I guess you kind of cut out there a little bit for me, but I have, you know, two responses to that. And one is that, you know, it's interesting to see that these, I'm thankful on one hand, but it's also appalling on another, is the art market doesn't seem to have slowed down at all in those higher price-ranged artworks, you know, that we're living in a society that's squabbling over paying people a decent living wage, and then yet that's happening at the same time is one thing. It seems that the wealthy have still been able to spend a great deal of money even during this time of COVID, which I find interesting. And then on the flip side to the second part of what I heard you say, something else really interesting is happening during COVID as far as accessibility to art goes. I think in some ways, because there is so much online, in some ways it has become way more accessible. I mean, my husband and I live in Vermont, and so often there's programming happening in New York, for instance, that we wish we could see, but now everything's on Zoom. So we got to hear this amazing artist Solomon Tour speak last week, and then there was a panel discussing Frank Auerbach's work, and normally that would be something we couldn't, you know, do without driving to the city. So I think there's kind of a two things. Some accessibility is definitely, there's more accessibility on one hand during this COVID time, for sure.
Which is wonderful.
Yeah.
Well, you are the perfect person to say something about this, because you and Eric are both artists, which is share your thoughts about living with real works of art around you and how they feed you each and every day as you have them in your home and experience the gifts that they provide you as you walk through a room or, you know, sit in direct or indirect contemplation of them, you know, while you're just in your environment.
Yeah, I mean, we're lucky. I think you visited our home, yes?
Yes.
I think you have. Our home is just covered in artwork, which is wonderful. I feel very fortunate, and many of them made by friends of ours and some others that are just fine collectible pieces. For instance, Frank Auerbach, who I mentioned before. We have a nice collection. I will say, if I'm just being totally honest, when you're living in a world with stuff around you, you kind of can stop seeing it sometimes. Like, it's just like on your walls. I feel sometimes I'll notice something that I'd forgotten was even hanging there for a while, which is nice. You see it new. And I think it's good to shuffle artwork around so you're looking at it differently, really. I'm thankful my kids have grown up with these objects on their walls, in their bedroom and around the house as well.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's definitely informed the way they consider things and look at the world, no doubt. Yeah. I just can't stress enough the importance of having live art, real art, whether you go to an undergraduate, you know, exhibition, which is part of the requirement for an art degree, and buy things for $50 or $100, but to have something that was handmade and contains the energy of the artist and the work itself around you is truly a life-affirming and sustaining addition to one's life. And
yeah.
Really, and particularly
it
now,
so
yes, and particularly now as we deal with the virus and other surprises, it's so important that we feed that, you know, feed that energy and creativity within ourselves and our homes.
Yes, I think that when I was speaking before a little bit about what became really apparent, what was important during these times, like this circle of friends, some basic needs, but also I feel like writing, poetry, creativity, paintings, and even really the television shows, which are, you know, I hate to say, but I think they've come a long way to being closer to films, and they're, you know, all of the works of art are things that people are experiencing still and that make the list for quality of life, for sure.
I agree with you, Rachel. I think that's completely true. The TV has definitely gone up several notches, and I you know, I feel so sad in a way that feature films are taking such a hit, because I love going to the movies, but
yeah.
It if at this moment in time, it's just the way it is.
Yeah. I mean, so if you do include television shows and other things in the mix, art is very much what's sustaining people in this kind of isolating time.
Exactly. That's really true. So we're getting towards the end of our hour, and I'm curious to know if you have anything you'd like to add about your work that you want our audience to be aware of.
I'm just thankful to have a venue to show it and that it's been received so well. It's made me feel really nice and given some, you know, outside validation of what I've been making in a kind of a bubble for so long. I've made these images not really thinking, you know, or unsure they would ever be seen. I've really loved them myself. I feel connected to them, and it feels really nice to know that other people feel that way as well. And I'm really looking forward to getting back to work. I can't wait to be making images again. Putting up a show and dealing with press and writing about it and all that takes a considerable amount of time, and I'm looking forward to what happens next, even though I don't know what that is exactly.
Has the virus impacted attendance, or have people been getting to the museum to see all of the shows that are up now?
I'm sure. I know just even from my show that the virus has impacted attendance tremendously. My mom is going to fly out from California. My brother from Colorado. My friends from Canada were all planning to fly and have a big celebration around my opening, which can't happen. So. I think that it must be impacting attendance of the other shows as well. But the flip side of that is that because of the pandemic and not as many people will see it in person, the museum has these amazing 3D interactive walkthroughs, these talks that are live, so many other ways to engage people. And I think ultimately, though not in person, more people will be reached and engaged in all of the exhibitions there as a result.
And that may lead to people spending more time with art on the Internet in general, which would be very positive.
So. Without a doubt. And I think that that is likely to happen, and I'm hoping it does.
Yeah, that would be wonderful. Art is one of those things that the more time you spend with it, the more you learn. And the more you then understand how to find the meaning in the work of multiple artists, which, you know, without the exploration and the commitment in terms of time, you might miss a number of things. But we really are in a place where so much more is available online that it can be a tremendous asset. Ultimately.
Yeah, I agree. And maybe some other unknown student artists might have a larger reach as well, which is exciting.
Right, absolutely. Absolutely. Although it's still, I was just going to say, to see a work in person is still such an extraordinary thing.
Yes, it's really different. I feel that very much with my work, which is kind of dark and reflective in person. You're in how your perspective can change with your eyes when you're looking at a work. You can like see yourself in the work if you're standing in front of one of my pieces, which is really different than the images that are online. I think that's true with all kinds of artwork.
Absolutely. And I was fortunate to be able to see your work in person at the museum, and the scale also plays such an important role, which you're not aware of so much if you're seeing it online.
Yeah, it is a different experience for sure.
Well, Rachel, thank you so much for joining us. This has been a wonderful interview, and we will have your biographical information and website and links to the show online with this interview so people can get in touch if they're interested in your work and learn more about you.
Well, thank you, Mia. And I just want to say how much I appreciate New Observations magazine and the issues it addresses. You're a huge fan of yours, and you're doing amazing work and just really contributing to goodness and progress in the world. And go New Observations.
Thank you so much. Yes, we're trying. We're trying. It's an amazing thing to have the legacy of the magazine, which in January will be 36 years. It's so hard to believe. And
wow.
Lucha Pozzi, our founder, is a close friend, and our association has gone on. You know, I was around when he started the magazine, so our progress in terms of creating the online free digital library has slowed because of the virus, but Rhode Island School of Design and the Museum of Modern Art have been helping to digitize the back issues. So all of the issues of the magazine are available to read online for free, or the new ones are, and the old inventory will be soon. And about 40 institutions around the country, including MoMA and the New York Public Library and MIT and Cornell and RISD and Yale and Harvard, have complete sets. So we're out there, slowly but surely. We're rebuilding.
Excellent. Congratulations on that.
Thank you. And we look forward to your guest editorship of an issue on hair in contemporary art.
Yes,
it'll
I'm
be very exciting. So thank you so much for joining us, and bye for now.